When Bridget Bishop was arrested and brought in for questioning in mid-April 1692, she was among three others who had been accused of bewitching the same group of girls and young women who claimed to be afflicted. We know their names well by now. Ann Putnam Jr., Abigail Williams, Elizabeth Hubbard, and Mercy Lewis all pointed a finger at Bishop, who was arrested the same day as Giles Corey, Abigail Hobbs, and one-time accuser herself, Mary Warren. This flurry of activity seemed to make clear once and for all that Salem was in the midst of a unique and serious crisis. In addition to the first three women, Sarah Good, Sarah Osborne, and Tituba, who were arrested 7 weeks earlier, Giles Corey's wife, Martha, Sarah Good's four-year-old daughter, Dorothy, Elizabeth and John Proctor, Sarah Cloyce, and perhaps most surprisingly of all, Sarah's sister, the much-revered Rebecca Nurse, were all now facing charges of witchcraft. Events seemed to be moving quickly now, and at this point, the only question that seemed to matter was when this nightmare would end. It's probably fair to say, given this sudden influx of accusations and arrests, that few in Salem at that time could have expected the crisis to pass anytime soon. 3 weeks earlier, at the end of March, Reverend Samuel Parris had given a fiery sermon warning the community that, quote, "Christ knows how many devils there are." His implication was clear. The people of Salem did not know how many among them were in the devil's thrall, and it was their job to find out. God was testing them, and it seemed that by mid-April, the authorities were taking this responsibility very seriously. At the time of her arrest, Bridget Bishop was likely in her late 50s and married to her third husband, Edward. She had been twice widowed. Born in England as Bridget Playfer, she likely immigrated to Massachusetts in the 1660s, well after the Great Puritan migration of the 1630s and 40s, settling in Salem Town, not Salem Village, where many of the other accused and accusers lived. During her examination at Ingersoll's Tavern, when the magistrates asked Bishop what her response was to the allegations that she had harmed the afflicted girls, her succinct response seemed to reflect her status as an outsider. "I never saw these persons before, nor I never was in this place before," she is recorded as saying. Yet in spite of Bishop's relative distance from the center of the action, it seemed that most in the region were well aware of one aspect of her past, and the authorities quickly turned to the subject that must have been on the minds of nearly everyone who had gathered that April day to witness her examination. Bridget Bishop had had a very turbulent relationship with her second husband, Thomas Oliver, who had died 13 years earlier in 1679. Not only did the two quarrel regularly, often violently, but they did so in public, or at least within the plain view of others. Neighbors claimed to have found them both bloodied and bruised after fighting with each other. On multiple occasions, the bishops were convicted of fighting or arguing with each other on the Sabbath. Once, they were both made to stand in the public square, gagged and with notes attached to their foreheads explaining what they had done. Oliver's daughter from his previous marriage paid a fine to release her father from this humiliating situation, but declined to pay her stepmother's fine, forcing Bridget Bishop to endure her embarrassment in public even longer. Given their rocky relationship, when Oliver passed away, it's no surprise that Bridget Bishop faced some suspicion. It was likely her stepchildren that planted the seed, and months later, in 1680, Bishop would indeed stand trial on charges of witchcraft. Not much is known from that earlier trial except that John Ingersoll's slave, a man known as Juan, testified that Bridget Bishop's specter had stolen some eggs from their property and scared some horses. Ultimately, and perhaps ironically given what would happen a dozen years later, Bishop was acquitted due to a lack of evidence against her. In any case, despite her acquittal, Bridget Bishop's previous witchcraft accusations would come back to haunt her with devastating results. "They say you bewitched your first husband to death," one of the magistrates asked Bishop at the beginning of her examination that mid-April day at Ingersoll's. "If it please your worship, I know nothing of it," Bishop responded, and as she shook her head no, the so-called afflicted girls who were in attendance at the examination broke into grievous fits. By now, this call-and-response behavior between the accused and the accusers had become a regular occurrence, yet being witness to such unusual and startling behavior seemed to exert a powerful force on the authorities. In spite of the commotion before her, Bishop continued to firmly deny the charges against her, regardless of the questions being asked. "I am no witch," she said. "I am innocent. I know not what a witch is." The magistrate seemed to grow frustrated and eventually asked her how she could know she was not a witch if she did not know what a witch was. The annoyed authorities eventually took a different approach, informing Bishop that another person they had examined that day had confessed to witchcraft. They were likely referring to Abigail Hobbs, who had claimed during her own examination to, quote, having been very wicked. When Bishop claimed to have no knowledge of Hobbs' confession, others in attendance revealed that they had told Bishop about Hobbs' admission of guilt. "Why look," the authorities said, "you are taken now in a flat lie." Unbothered, Bishop claimed not to have heard the news about Hobbs and continued to categorically deny the charges against her. And like it was in so many other cases during the witch crisis, Bridget Bishop's denials did nothing to serve her cause. She was eventually indicted on 5 counts of witchcraft and sent to jail to await her trial. The following month, Massachusetts Governor William Phipps established a new court of Oyer and Terminer to handle the growing number of witchcraft cases in Salem. The court was a collection of revered men from across the colony, and on June 2nd, they sat for the very first time for Bridget Bishop's one-day trial. And while Bishop might not have been the first person to be accused during the Salem witch crisis, her trial was likely selected to be first because of the litany of individuals who were willing to testify against her. As many as 10 people made claims that Bishop had either bewitched them or engaged in some sort of nefarious behavior over the years. Some of the testimony during her trial contained fantastical accusations about flying monkeys and odd-looking pigs. There were numerous accusations about Bridget Bishop bewitching them, their children, or their livestock after a quarrel. There were claims that Bishop's specter beat and attacked people in their beds at night. She was accused of causing an apple to fly from a man's hand across the room. And perhaps most damning of all, workmen claimed to have found poppets in her home, tiny dolls that many believed witches made to represent people as a means for bewitching them. The authorities also claimed to have found a witch's mark on Bishop as well. What was most likely a harmless blemish or skin tag was taken to be irrefutable evidence that the devil had marked Bishop as his servant. The The avalanche of testimony and evidence against Bridget Bishop seemed as if it was pulled directly from a book of cliches about witches. And all the while, the girls and young women whose accusations led to Bishop's indictments continued to make dramatic vocalizations and engage in other wild behaviors that seemed to help seal Bishop's fate. The various accusations against Bishop, as well as the unusual actions of the afflicted, made it obvious to those at Bishop's trial that she must have been guilty. Acclaimed theologian Cotton Mather, writing about the trial, noted that there was, quote, little occasion to prove witchcraft, it being evident and notorious to all beholders. Like many 17th century Puritan immigrants to America, Bridget Bishop did not live an easy life. In addition, she also lived outside the highly limited boundaries of Puritan womanhood. From openly fighting back or even instigating violence against her husband, to fearlessly standing up against those she felt had done her wrong, to wearing clothing that was considered flamboyant or unbecoming of a good woman, it was clear Bridget Bishop made many people in Salem uncomfortable. And tragically for her, it was this quality more than anything else that made her the ideal first victim of this tragedy. Eight days after being found guilty, Bishop was hauled from her cell and driven on a cart to Proctor's Ledge, where a newly constructed gallows stood. The hangman placed a rope around her neck, and the cart was quickly pulled away, leaving Bishop's feet dangling just inches above the ground. The short drop made for a slow and agonizing death. While it was only the beginning of the tragedy that would unfold over the coming months, the execution of Bridget Bishop seemed to temporarily satiate the community's desire for vengeance against this perceived evil. For a couple of weeks at least, fewer people claimed to be afflicted, but unfortunately, this reprieve would not last long. And while many must have felt some sense of relief at Bridget Bishop's demise, her conviction and execution did seem to plant the first seeds of doubt that would continue to grow as the summer progressed. Days before Bishop was hanged, one of the judges on the court of Oyer and Terminer, Nathaniel Saltonstall, resigned, presumably out of discontent with the court's decision about her guilt and execution. Then, days after Bishop was put to death, Governor Phipps, who was said to be surprised by the quick actions of the court, gathered a collection of advisors, including four of the judges who sat on the court, to discuss how the proceedings were going. The council made the decision to solicit the opinions of several well-respected ministers. The minister's brief report, written 2 days later by Cotton Mather, offered a carefully worded yet vigorous defense of the court's handling of the crisis. In spite of this, embedded within the report were some faint words of caution as well. Reverend Mather reminded the governor that the devil was more than capable of impersonating an innocent person, and that so-called spectral evidence, wild accusations by those who claim to be afflicted, about specters of the accused appearing before them and engaging in evil activities, should be used with caution. The distracted governor, who was preoccupied with fears of conflict with native peoples on the New England frontier, was not interested in nuance. Instead, he viewed the report from the ministers as a seal of approval for the court. Yet there were others who were disquieted by Bridget Bishop's execution as well. In particular, a Baptist minister in Boston named William Milbourne filed two petitions to the governor urging the court to discontinue its use of spectral evidence in the trials. However, such strong opinions coming from a Baptist minister who was seen as a troublemaker did not sit well with the governor and his Puritan allies. Milbourne's concerns were dismissed out of hand, and he was even summoned before the governor's council to be scolded in order to pay a crushing bond of £200 for making such, quote, scandalous accusations. While there's little doubt that the seeds of concern had been planted, at least in certain circles, it was clear that the work of the court would continue unabated for months ahead. Unfortunately, it would take much more dissent before the convictions and executions would finally be over. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.